Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
J.R. Jim Henson is a fourth-generation Paradise resident and survivor of the devastating campfire that destroyed his family home. Walks with his grandfather nurtured Jim's interest in preserving nature, and he's known as a compassionate activist. Jim started his writing career last year with his book Reflections and Dark Truths. Writing under the name J.R. Henson, Jim has now published his second book, Unseasonable. He will be having a book signing Tuesday, July 30th at 6:30 at the Chico branch of the Butte County Library. Jim Henson, welcome.
Thank you.
The campfire was just such a turning point. There was life before that and life after that. And your family had lived there for so many generations. I can't imagine what it must have been like. Where were you when the fire broke out?
Well, I was home. We lived on Tranquil Drive. And that's a really nice area close to the cliffs. Valley View is where the cliffs on one side of the canyon. And on that day, I had woken up early and heard a kind of a kaboom sound and didn't make much of it, just thought that was strange. And then I decided to go take a shower, and I looked out the shower window, and all of a sudden, it looked like a big, huge, dark clouds were moving in, kind of like fog, and it was moving in quickly. And I just thought, oh, somebody has a fire in their chimney, something like that. That's when my mother banged on the door and said, we got to get out of here. And she said that the neighbors had come across the street and said that they had heard on the TV that we were all evacuating. So there wasn't any notice, no call, and you didn't hear any sirens, police sirens or fire sirens, nothing like that. So it didn't seem like an emergency. So even though I thought, we'll go, because 2008, there was a fire, we all evacuated, and the year before that, there was a small fire that would have been big right at the canyon. However, there was already planes in the air, and they just diverted them over there and just bombed them with borate, and it snuffed out the fire right away. We didn't even get out of the parking lot with our evacuation stuff, our house, before it was all completed. So this made it just sound like, we'll go about our business. And, I grabbed stuff slowly and thought, I'll take the dog with me this time, but we'll be back.
So in their household was you, your mother and dad, and your dog.
Right.
And you had to figure out, what do we do now?
Right. So because of the 2008 fire, we already had plans in place, like where to meet, and that we were all going to take cars, and that what we already had a bag set aside that had clothes and things that we needed, medicines and things like that that we needed. So that we always carried it within the trunk of one of the cars. So everything was already prepared. We already knew what to do. And now was just trying to figure out what extra to do before we left. And one of the things was like my thumb drive. I better get that, because all my writings were on the thumb drive. And I took all the crate that my dog would be in, and all the medicines that the dog has to take. So we were, we were running around. My dad would say that he wished he had taken both his watches. For some reason, he just took one and said, that's the most expensive one. But he misses the other one. Even now today, he said, I miss.
And your home was totally destroyed.
Totally destroyed. Yeah, I went up there last week, And this is, and they had called earlier and said, "Is it all right if we go on your property? Because we're going to clean it up now." And so I said yes, and I went up there to see what it looked like, and I parked in the driveway. Now the driveway had been cut in half by the bulldozer, and they had chewed up the entire house foundation. Everything was gone. All of the metal, everything. You couldn't even tell that it was a house there. And what was left was kind of just these small little mounds of dirt that you saw the tracks of the tractor had rolled over. Now the lawn was still there in the backyard, and there were big trees they didn't cut down, so they were still alive and well. So it was kind of funny to see there'd be a cement sidewalk or something, and then all of a sudden be chopped. Like, that was the end of that. So you thought, well, something was here, but I'm not really sure. And it was the very first time that I went up there where I was more relieved than sad, because it was cleaned up, right? I would go up there and everything, you would see your old refrigerator destroyed and your washer and dryer, everything burned and crumbled. And, you know, there's your chimney stack that's still holding up, but it's ready to fall. And you're just looking around at this big ash heap mess. And the walls were pink because of the asbestos that, you know, burned right into the walls. Because I asked my parents, I said, "I don't remember us ever painting these walls pink." And it says, well, that was because of the asbestos just glued in there. So prior to that, I would say that for the day that we left, we all left in separate cars, and we all left at different times. And we all took probably different directions out. There were two ways to get out, and I know I went exactly the wrong way compared to my parents. They took two different cars. And my way was a traffic jam at Valley View, and we couldn't get onto Oliver, which is Oliver connects at Skyway where the Jack in the Box was. And we sat there for hours. It felt like an hour, maybe two.
And when you say we, you mean you and Gabby.
Me and Gabby. And there were people that weren't abandoning their cars, but were walking back to their houses. And at that time, I thought, maybe they know something I don't. Maybe it's been all called off. Maybe, you know, this is just an after smoke that's being seen, right? And I thought, well, I'll still stay in this line anyway. And then it would start to move only because people were turning around and going back. So I kept moving forward inch by inch, and then it just completely stalled. And I looked at my gas tank, and it was less than a quarter of a tank was in there. And I was debating whether or not I should just go back home, because I didn't want to have the car abandoned in front of other people that had to get out. So I just kept watch of the needle that was slowly going down. Then what happened to make everything change was these first responders came, and they had vests on. And they got out of their car, you know, got out of the cars and started directing traffic. And we were all now moving, you know, up to where we needed to go. And even though it was still inching, and then we got to the top of the Oliver. And that's when I noticed that the sky was dark. And here it was noon, and it was darker than I've ever seen the sky. No stars, nothing.
My guest, by the way, is Jim Henson, and he lived in Paradise and his family, his ancestors lived in Paradise. He's a fourth generation Paradise resident, and his family home was destroyed in the campfire back in November of 2018. So you and your little dog, and you write about your little dog in your stories, in your essays, so she seems like a sensitive little creature. How is she taking this, Jim?
Well, so I had a bed for her, and I put it in the back of the – so I have two seats, and then I have extra in the truck, you know, back seats in the truck. And so I put it back there and thought, well, she'll just go right back there and lie down, and that will be fine, and we'll get out of here. And she immediately just climbed on to me and – actually was probably the driver of the car. In her terms, that would be she drove us out of there. There was a point when we got up to Valley View that she decided that there was a person standing there with a dog and decided to tell the dog, bark at the dog, you know. So she, I don't think she really was as frightened about it, but it kept me sane through it too. When we got, like I said, when we got to Skyway, you could see the red tail lights all the way down, like Christmas lights, you know, ornaments. And we just followed that all the way down. And I had been hearing on the radio about them opening up all four lanes of Skyway, that there had been this problem in down there where there's this gas station, Valero gas station, and people were going to that and then trying to get gas. So they stopped, and there was a line stopped all the way up to Paradise from that place, right, because people were waiting to get in and get gas. So that was really terrible for, you know, I would gather the people that started it, you know, started coming down.
Did you know where you were going? I know you just probably at first thought, well, I've got to get out of Paradise. Did you have a destination?
We did. We all agreed that we were going to meet at the Morning Thunder's parking lot that's on Vallambrosa. And so that was whether – no
Chico.
Matter what time in Chico, whether it was night or day or whatever, that was always going to be our spot. So when I got down to Neal Road, that's where the fire was. And it was tearing the houses down to its skeleton. You know, you saw the foundation – you saw the wood frames, and it was just burning crazy. When I chose to go on the one way that would be coming up, and that was completely engulfed in fire. My car had felt like it was so hot that I was actually in one of those crematoriums, you know, where your car – I couldn't touch the sides of the car. And I saw in front of me just these huge embers dancing across the road in front of my car because the wind was blowing so much that everything was fast. And so by the time I pushed through that, I saw that the Paradise sign was on fire. And I knew that this was going to be trouble. I didn't see at all any fire trucks at all putting out any of the blazes. It was so fast that I can't even imagine a truck going from Chico and driving all the way up before it was inferno. When I got halfway down, and remember, I'm almost out of gas, and I'm thinking –
I remember, thank goodness it's downhill.
I'm thinking now, well, at least I got out of the place where I would hate to have run out of gas in the fire itself. I could see that there were sometimes these burned-out cars on the side of the road of Skyway, and I thought, well, maybe did the fire get all the way down here? Because I didn't see anything there, and I just kept on traveling, hoping that I could get as far away from the fire as possible before my gas ran out. So luckily, I made it all the way to Chico and was able to get gas. But I would – and my dad took Neal Road. And he said that there was no problem until he got onto the freeway. And then it was completely backed up and there was a fire down there, you know, that was covering that. and my mom went down Skyway. And even though she left later than I did and later than my dad did, she was the first to get there. Can you believe that? And she was there like an hour before any of us. In fact, my dad called me on my cell phone to say where I was, and I was just still heading down Skyway. And my mom's like, what took you two so long to get here?
Well, in your book, because since this is a new book, I thought, well, maybe some of the essays are about the fire. And so I kept reading, and the only one that I thought, maybe this is post-fire, you talk about what it's like to be homeless. Hmm. Now, is that from firsthand experience, Jim, if I may ask?
No. That was a story that came to me, and I can actually relate to people that are in that situation, and I've, you know, helped serve at the Jesus Center. So I just started thinking about what that would be like. When I volunteered at the Peace and Justice Center, we had an exercise one night to just go out in the middle of the night and see what it's like for a few hours in the cold and see how long you can stay outside homeless. Look, you know, you're worried about where you're going to sleep. You don't know where that is. You're worried about everything. Who's coming to you? You know, you're worried about the police. Because you don't know what the rules are. How long can you sleep on the park bench? So it was.
So that essay came from experience that you had voluntarily. You chose to see what it was like to be a homeless person.
Right. Yes.
Well, your essays, I mentioned you wrote these, I'm assuming most of them were written before, maybe even before the fire.
Oh, yeah. They were all written.
Because some of them go back to when you were quite young.
Yeah. I had finished one book, but I already had the makings of a second book. And this was all before the fire. So I thought after that I would write a third book about the experiences of the fire and see what, you know, I wanted to take a certain amount of time, right? A block of time and just write about that, not long drawn out, 6 months, 10, you know, that's that way.
My guest is J.R. Jim Henson, and he lived in Paradise up until November of 2018. He has a new collection of poems and essays he calls Unseasonable. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is a survivor of the campfire, and he is a poet and essayist. His newest collection of poems and essays is Unseasonable. You mentioned, Jim, that storytelling has been a part of both sides of your family, and one of your ancestors I've heard of, the poet James Russell Lowell.
I know. My great-grandmother, her maiden name is Lowell, and on my father's side. And my grandmother decided to look at our roots. And she went all the way down and found that we were one of the people is Percival Lowell. And my dad says that he was honored in some way by the Queen. But James Russell was another person. And it's interesting because of the fact that they considered him almost like a scholar, like an English scholar, you know, from the Americans, you know, that wild country, and that they had enough education to write as sophisticated poems as us Englishmen.
Well, for people who may not think they have heard of James Russell Lowell, your ancestor, they probably have heard the poem, "What is so rare as a day in June?" that your ancestor wrote that. Now, your poems vary. You have poems scattered throughout your book under various categories. So how did you categorize your writing? Because some of them could go kind of in any of the sections. How did you set up your book?
This time I was taking a piece out of Shakespeare, where they interpret Shakespeare with the seven stages of life, from living to dead. And what I wanted to do was write stories about the different emotions, stories around different emotions, and also the last one is called drama, because these are stories that just aren't put in that category, in any category.
Well, since you mentioned it, I know people have heard this because it's one of my favorite lines. This is from Shakespeare's As You Like It. "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. He acts, his acts being seven stages." And like you mentioned, infant, schoolboy, soldier, old age are some of these stages. And you kind of continue that theme, that motif, with the graphics. For example, you have masks, theater masks, right, in the start of each of your sections. For example, the first section of your book is happiness. And as you might guess, here's a mask, smiling mask. And so each section of your book, we kind of look at this mask and say, oh, that represents sadness, death. You mentioned drama.
Right.
as the last one. And your first section is happiness. And the poem, I find it's really touching. I don't know that I would even say happiness. It touched my heart, Jim. Would you read what you wrote on page 10, "I'll Be Waiting"?
Sure. "When the ocean touches the sky, I'll be waiting. When the stars shine bright, I'll be waiting. I'll be waiting. I'll be waiting for you, for you, for you, to greet me at the door, to listen to me snore, to be in my arms forever. I'll be waiting, I'll be waiting. Your lips upon my face, the feeling of your grace, and my heartbeat's simple race. I'll be waiting, I'll be waiting. When the sun is up so high, when the river meets the sea."
This is Jim Henson, writes under J.R. Henson, reading from his newest book, one of the poems, and this one was "I'll Be Waiting." You have a similar tone to your poem, "Forever." You say, "When the leaves come down, the sun does shine, and our love together is yours and mine." This is on page 12.
Sure.
Jim, could you finish that sentence here?
Here. Mm-hmm. "Forever doesn't seem so lonely anymore. In the darkest hours, I can still see your face and discover mine is no longer blind. All the leaves are down, the sun rests now, and we are placed in our graves together. Forever isn't lonely anymore."
Now, you have this under happiness, and yet you say we are placed in our grave together. I mean, that's a beautiful thought. You say forever isn't lonely anymore.
Right, because I think there's a fear about death, that we will be lonely and that we won't be around and there won't be anybody with us. And I wanted to write a poem that says that no matter what happens to either one of us, we'll still be there, you know, together forever. and that it isn't lonely now because I'm with you before we get to the grave, you know.
Because it does come up, and I don't remember which essay right now, this idea that you have that kind of fear yourself, apparently, if you are speaking for yourself in the essay, that there is that kind of fear that you'll be alone at that moment of death.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I had a moment where my asthma was so bad, and I was in my bedroom and dark, and I was trying to see if I could just contain it without having to go to the hospital and getting shots and stuff.
By the way, this essay you call The Voice.
Voice.
And so you're wondering whether you should listen to that voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I really thought this, you know, that I was going to die lonely. It was going to get really dark and I was going to go.
And you used the term mask in this essay too.
Yeah. I don't know where that is, but what I can remember right now is realizing that that there is this loneliness if you're passing away. And so from that, I remember waking up from that feeling and going and getting my mom, and we headed to the hospital. And so there was, you know, like that a voice kind of sharing that.
And what happened on the way to the hospital? Here you are on your way to the hospital, and did this really happen, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
You get in an automobile, a truck, the two vehicles involved were trucks.
Right. So it was raining, heavily raining, and it was on Billy Road and Clark. And this was before there was a signal there, light signal there. And my mom was relying on me to tell her when the traffic was okay my way while she was looking at the traffic the other way. And I told her right after this truck, it would be okay. Well, she saw a different truck. And so we pulled into the intersection, and it was a PG&E truck, right? So, and immediately I get this voice in my head that says, bend down. And I bend down. The truck hits my side to a point where the dent comes in and I can feel it touch my ribs. Glass shatters over the top of me from that passenger door. And I get back up and get out of the truck. And the PG&E guy is just like, I am so surprised. I can't believe that you survived, you know, all this glass and everything. And so after everything calmed down, then the ambulance had to take me to the hospital because we didn't have the truck.
They had to tow the truck.
They had to tow the truck, yes. Both trucks, our truck, which was a Ford, and the PG&E truck, just to get it out of the, you know, out of the way, because it was right in the middle of the intersection. And it's pouring down rain, and you're just, you know, you don't know what, you know, I mean, I was shocked. My mom was shocked. You know, we're just cold and wet and shivering. You know, nothing that we're wearing was preparing for, you know, rain. We were just headed right to the emergency hospital to get in and out. So here I am soaked, my mom soaked, and there's no cell phone. We didn't have cell phone. You couldn't even go to – there wasn't a phone booth in and around there. You were just hoping, you know, somebody would call it in, right, at that time. So we were lucky that somebody had done that. And then when I got to the hospital, they give you a shot for your asthma to calm down your asthma. And they had to give me a heavy dose because I was really at the point of hardly breathing.
Because you're already having trouble breathing before you left home.
Yes.
And then you're involved in this automobile
right.
accident. And as if that weren't enough, it sounded like in your essay that you had a sense of guilt because, oh my gosh, this was my fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are certain ones I think I wrote. There are certain times that I've had been saved from death. When I was 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old, I rode a tricycle around the apartment complex's pool until I finally just slipped in. The tricycle and I slipped into the shallow end of the pool. I didn't want to give up my tricycle. And so I went down with the tricycle and I didn't get up. But I could see through the water, and I don't know how I did it, but I could see that there was a woman running towards me. And she lifted me and the tricycle, because I wasn't going to leave that tricycle in there, and lifted us both out of the water. And later I talked to my parents about it, and they said she was always retrieving kids out of the – so they put a big fence around it. But at that time, another save, and I had – later in my life, 2 different times where a gun was pointed at me, and
you didn't write about this.
Yeah,
maybe this is for your next book.
Maybe so. And both times, you know, whatever you do under pressure, you know, you don't know until it happens. And the first time, I just blundered all the way through the whole thing, and the gun was loaded, and the person wasn't. Well, he moved around in this fast food restaurant, sitting with some customers with the gun, coming up and showing, you know, pointing the gun at me. And my first thought was to go back and call 911 while he was pointing the gun at me. So I run back and I hit my girlfriend that is washing dishes and going to the grill. And once I hit her head on, I realized I must be dead. And I turned around and there's the gun pointed at me long distance, and I walk back up there. And then I start handing over the cash, and the person that was up front was like pointing at where all the cash is. It's in here. It's over there. I was like, quiet. And they caught him as he was circling, you know, back around. So the police caught him, and then they took me over, and I had to identify him. Later, I went, you know, I had to go to court to identify, and they asked me to listen to the 911 tape that I made my call. And all the way through it, I'm so scared that I'm giggling. And they're thinking, this is all a hoax. But I'm so afraid, so I'm just giggling all the way through it. And they just wanted to say, look, before you get on up there in the jury box, you might want to think about what this is, you know, this, not to giggle as you're going through it. Yeah.
My guest is J.R. Henson, Jim Henson, who up until November of 2018 lived in Paradise, and he has written a collection of essays and poems. And one of your poems, Jim, mm-hmm. This is one that I find kind of humorous. You have it in your section called Happiness. You want to read that one called Impossible
Sure.
Odds?
Barn owl watches during the night. Cats take over throughout the day. Rodents can't win this fight. Still, the rats find time to play.
I have to chuckle at that because the poor – I mean, I never thought I would feel sorry for rats. But in the daytime, cats will be after them, and in the nighttime, barn owls will be after them. There's no way they're going to get out alive.
And that's where we just feel like there's nowhere for us to run in our lives. And yet we still have a life that we can set aside and enjoy. We can separate ourselves from a hard day at work and separate ourselves from the bills that we have to pay and the kind of sadness in our life to go out and maybe have a go out to dinner with our family, to a restaurant, or do something really nice, go to a playground, whatever we want to do. So we're able to say, even though there's these impossible odds, we can still find time to really care for one another.
And that's what you end that poem, "Still the Rats Find Time to Play." Now, so that was from your section under the topic, the rubric happiness. Some of your stories are sad, and you write about, and I'm assuming this is you speaking, you call it an addiction.
Yes.
And I think most people have an addiction of some sort, but yours is one that I think a lot of people can identify with to some degree or another, Jim. And what is your addiction?
Well, my addiction is food. You might say I'm an overeater, you know, very compulsive, and it has ruled my life for such a long time. I think that with this story is explaining what addiction is like. And it, for me, it is talking about how it's been there forever and has been there taking care of me for the longest time. And it wants to let me know, do you know me? Because I really do know you.
By the way, that's the title of this essay, "Do You Know Me?" And you started by saying, "I know you. I really do know you. And I've known you for a very long time." And then you say down at the bottom of that page, "I'm just about everywhere and a part of almost every occupation you've ever had since you were 17. So in this essay, you have the addiction speaking. Mm-hmm. So when it says I, that's the addiction speaking.
Right.
And you are this person that he's talking. He, it is talking to. So, Jim, would you pick up there in that essay on that next page?
"So now after I have been your parent, your friend, your guardian, and your lover, you've decided once again to put me in some sort of cage? This is never going to happen this time around. In fact, no matter how much I know about you, I don't think you really know me at all. I am the disease, the parasite, and the drive to make you graze nonstop for hours upon hours. I am the distraction to avoid the confrontations of grief. I create the emptiness and the pseudo-substitute to fill that hole. You are my puppet on a string, and I'm the voice you think is reason. You can't close the cage on me because I've already closed the cage on you. With one thought, I can have you getting out of bed in the middle of the night and searching for a fast food place or a supermarket that's open to stop that thought from replaying over in your mind all night and into the next morning. I own you, and if you make me mad, I'll add another 30 pounds to your body weight. In fact, the way I see it, I'm all you've got left in this world. Isn't that right, my precious?"
This is J.R. Henson reading from his newest book, Unseasonable. It's a collection of poems and essays, and he lived in paradise up until November of 2018. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and I'm talking to my guest, Jim Henson. And here you have this addiction speaking to you at, I've got you. And isn't that right, my precious?
A friend of mine read that and said, I understand more about addiction after reading this than I did before, because I had a different way of thinking what addiction is. And some people think that addiction isn't a disease, but just, why don't you just snap out of it? Why don't you just stop drinking or stop smoking or stop doing drugs or stop? Why don't you just stop eating so much? Just stop. That's all you have to do. And the disease, the parasite within, is really the one that's in control and will listen to everything. The people that do that and just thinks, that's very nice of you to say, but you're not talking to the person that you need to talk to, and that's me, the parasite.
Well, when I read your essays, too, I feel like that person that you give me insight into what it's like, because I think most people don't talk about, say, depression the way you do. They don't talk about being so captivated, if that's the word, under the control of this addiction to food. And you talk about going to this buffet. You ate one plate full, another plate full, another plate full. And then after four plates full, you're thinking, well, okay, do I have a fifth plate full of food or do I leave? And we don't usually hear the person. Usually they aren't, I'm going to use the word brave enough to really tell us what it's like to have these feelings that, like you were describing, this addiction to food.
Right. Yeah, addictions are, people say you have to look at addictions like any disease, like cancer or anything. And the way that you beat those odds is really the help of other people around you, the support, positive support. You can't have a circle of friends that are negative or a circle of friends that are sabotaging you. They want you to come out and eat too, or the drinking buddies, you know. You stop drinking? We missed you at the bar. Come on back, all that fun. And you believe that when you are in that moment of euphoria, because it is this endorphin feeling, right? You need more endorphins to feel even more better. That's the addiction, is the endorphins. That at this high or this feeling, you finally are calm and reserved. And you feel that's the better part of you, is that all the other nervousness and craziness that's going on inside your life, inside your mind, it finally gets calmed. And that the food has done that, only that the food and other addictions only allow you to feel that way for a short amount of time until you have to have more to have that same feeling again. And that's the trick. That's the parasite itself. So if you can, there's people, you'll be amazed. People will have one drink or one plate of food, or, oh, they get stuffed off of one taco or something like that, you know. And you just go, how do you find stop? How do you find that?
I think one thing that makes, this is, I guess, not original with me, the addiction to food so difficult is that you can live without cigarette. You can live. You won't die if you don't have a cigarette. You can live without alcohol. But you do have to eat.
Okay.
So how do you cope with that?
You have to find a way of where your limitation is. You have to say that what I'm putting on my plate, that's it. For me, food is about safety and security. So I'm worried about the next meal. Will I have will I have the time, or will I be able to afford, or will I be able to get to the next meal? And when I'm afraid that that's not going to happen, I'm going to double eat right now, saying that I don't know what's going to happen in the future. So I better
eat
now. Right.
Well, you have different topics that you put your essays and poems under, and that one was under anger. And then you have one under fright that's called Lines on the Pavement. And in that, you write that you haven't been to your university classes. It's been 2 weeks since you went to any of your classes. And you're thinking, okay, I'm going to go to class today. And I wondered, you have it under the section of fright and the voice of panic you mentioned in there. But I knew this really great guy that had such severe depression that he couldn't get himself out of bed to get to work. And he was very skilled at his job, but his depression was such that he couldn't get to work. So I was wondering if this, you're labeling it fright, this not being able to make yourself go to class, was it a part of depression? What do you think?
It is a part of depression and avoidance. And when you have to confront things, and maybe we all have this feeling when there's something that's negative that we have to confront, maybe you have to fire somebody at your job and you got to confront that person. Or maybe you have to confront somebody about something that you did wrong and you have to just admit it. Or you have to confront somebody you've been in a relationship with and you see them across the hall. And now what are you going to do? Do you go over there or do you avoid them altogether? Well, when I stopped going to class, the avoidance would get stronger and stronger, right? Because each day you're missing the class makes it harder to want to return. And the
professor's going to want to ask you about it, and you don't want to talk about it. So in your essay, you don't even go. You get there a little late, so you say, well, I'm not going to go in the classroom now. I'll stand here outside the door and listen. And then when the students all come out, I can avoid talking to the instructor.
Yeah.
What you want to do is, and you say it's a more than a 2.5-hour drive up into the wooded area to recover. And I thought about your grandfather and your love of nature that he engendered. And so you find that driving up in a wooded area is a way of soothing these feelings. And then what were you going to say about this avoidance?
When I drove up there, I drove as far as I could possibly go up to as you're heading to Chester. And I was searching for an answer. I was searching for something that would come in and take away this fear or take away all of the things that create this depression or avoidance. And I thought if I could just park, off the road and get out and be with nature, that somehow it would re-energize me, give me the strength, right? That I could come down there and I could meet the teacher at his room, his office, and just share, hey, this is what's going on with me. But instead was this emptiness of, when is this going to happen? Here I am in the woods. When is this going to happen? It's very beautiful, but I'm looking for this answer and it's not coming to me. And I guess I have to do it myself, to the point where you now have to realize, well, it's getting dark and you better leave. It's not happening today.
My guest is J.R. Henson. That's what he writes under, Jim Henson. And his collection of poems and essays are Unseasonable. Now, you end your book with something very dramatic. In fact, there are two masks ahead of this section called Drama.
Drama.
And this is called A Bitter Bean. And You know what, Jim, this one, because one time you give voice to this parasite of addiction that's the I that's speaking, and usually we can kind of tell it's a man speaking these other essays, and then I get to Bitter Bean, and it sounds like the person telling this story is a woman.
It is a woman, and this is the second part. In the first part in my first book, we have her not getting married. She comes to her resolution that she's not going to get married and that she has to leave. And I don't know about anybody else that's a writer, but for me, there are characters that live inside, you know, are roaming around. And you never know if you're ever going to write about them again. Are they ever going to come back up and tell you another story? And so this one came up and shared more of this story. Okay, she's left. She's in the car. She's taking away. Well, what happens to her? Well, now in Bitter Bean, you find out she's at this motel and there's no cell phone coverage, nothing. There's no way to get any information out. And she's at the worst coffee shop you could possibly
be. So that bean in the title is a coffee bean,
yes.
Bitter Bean, yes.
Right. And I think there's one in there, a part in there that says, I should have known that this was a terrible place to drink coffee because no one else is here but me, you know.
Yeah. And in fact, we get that impression from Rudy that it's terrible coffee that she's consuming. Now, I don't want to give away the part of what really happens to this woman because
right.
we want people to read the stories
right.
or to come to your book signing next Tuesday, July 30th at the Butte County Library in Chico. And I'm sure you'll be reading from this book, Jim. It's a pleasure talking to you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, you.
Jim. My guest has been writer and poet J.R. Henson. His latest book is Unseasonable.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.